Hi, today is January 28th, 2016. My name is Deborah Schwartz, and I am sitting here with Bob Greenwood. Mr. Greenwood, as many know you, is a musician and a music educator, longtime educator here in Mill Valley at Tam High and also another school. Bob, first of all, I want to say thank you so much for sitting down with me today. And I sit here on behalf of the Mill Valley Historical Society Oral History Program and the Mill Valley Library. And we are so excited to finally speak, I know I am personally, to this man I've been hearing so many musicians talk about.
Uh-huh.
You're rather famous in the world of music.
Well, at least in Mill Valley.
In Mill Valley. Okay, well, now you've been in the area for quite some time, haven't you?
Yes.
Yes. So let's start, first of all, with some basic information about you and your family. Tell me your name and when you were born and a little
bit
about
my name is Robert Joseph Greenwood, and I was born in August of 1928. Which means I'm 78 at the moment.
No.
I mean, 87.
Yeah.
I've got it backward.
Yes.
Okay, and I was born in Charles City, Iowa, which is a small town between Mason City and Waterloo. Well, it's not that small, really. But my parents were both from the area. My dad grew up and was born on a farm in a short distance from Charles City. And mother was born in Sleepy Eye, Minnesota, which is still there, which is amazing. And she moved with her family to Charles City, I guess, shortly after birth.
And your parents' names were?
Warren Greenwood and Ethel. Actually, her maiden name was Green. And she was a county recorder, one of the earliest women in at that time in Floyd County, elected to a public office. And she was county recorder. I don't know if that is important. My dad had always been involved with cars and mechanics. And he went through a garage and he got out of that business, and he then ended up going into grocery business. And he had a grocery store up until the time we moved to California. And he was not doing too well. He ended up working on the National Labor Relations Act.
The National Labor Relations Act?
You know, that thing where you work for the government.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was how we got through the Depression. No one had any money, of course, cash, and everybody bartered. And so it wasn't a good time to be in business. My dad ended up going back to machinery, and he started by working down in southern Iowa and at a bomb factory, of all things. And he discovered that he was allergic to gunpowder. And so he came back home, and about that time, this is when we were getting over the fact that the Japanese had bombed Pearl Harbor, and Bechtel came through Charles City and recruited people to go out and work in the shipyards. And my dad announced one day at lunch, we're moving. And that's how I got to California.
So you were in Iowa with your family, comfortable, and as most people were about that time, and then suddenly mm-hmm. you're going to be going to California.
So Dad went, and everything was up to my mother to arrange the thing. And of course, in those days, you had to ship things by train because there was no...
You didn't have a car.
Well, we had a car, but we couldn't ship everything in
mm-hmm.
So my grandfather boxed everything up and shipped it by train. So then we came out. And the day we left Charles City, I think it was January 28th.
You remember the day? Is that today, is that, are we talking the anniversary of January 28th?
No, we aren't, as a matter of fact, but it happened. But that was the day we left Charles City, and it's the day it was snowing, and it was 29 below zero.
And yet, what year is this now? We're talking 1943. Okay.
Yeah, 1943.
So it's snowing? Like, doesn't it get a little cold in Iowa?
Oh, it was cold. I always tell people, in the old days, there was a weather map on things, and the loop would come down to, and then go back up. And for the cold, Charles City was right at the bottom of that loop every time.
Because it's a plains area,
right? Yeah, it was just very cold and very hot and muggy. It was beautiful in spring and fall, but awful otherwise. And I'm so glad to get out.
So you left without too much resistance?
None at all. No, I was ready to leave, and so was my mother, I guess. But anyhow, we came out here.
Did you have siblings as well?
I have a sister.
Mm-hmm.
And she's now in Santa Fe at the Rafael home. You know, the, what is it, the senior home? No, it's a rest home.
Mm-hmm.
And she's 5 years older than I am.
Holy cow.
Yes. My mother died at 104 months.
Oh, my goodness.
Yes. My dad had a problem. He acquired flu while he was in the Army. World War I.
He died of Spanish
flu? No, he didn't die. But he lost his sense of smell and his sense of taste in the process and had a god-awful diet. You know, he couldn't eat, taste anything, so he put salt on it and jam on pie, things like that, so he could taste something. Anyhow, he died of a heart thing. But that was not surprise. It just, it was surprising that it didn't happen sooner.
But he did, he survived the flu. He was lucky to live.
Yes, yes. Anyhow, my father went to work as a machinist in the Bechtel.
In Sausalito?
In Sausalito. And then we came out, and that was an experience, because going through the Altamont Pass and all that area, that was a two-lane road then.
Mm-hmm.
And it was spooky for people from Iowa.
Because you were used to the flatlands.
Got that right. Anyhow, we came across to Marin County on the ferry, because the bridge, of course, wasn't there. And
the bridge was built in 37, 38.
Oh, that's the Golden Gate. Oh, I'm talking about Richmond.
Oh, okay. Right.
Richmond Ferry. Yes. Yeah. And no, that was... it must be over 25 or 30 years ago that the Richmond Bridge was born. That's a good way to put it.
So you came across the ferry.
Yeah, and we knew that we had a home in Marin City. And you have to understand that you take about there were so few houses in Marin County then, because the population was small. And suddenly, the people who came, my father brought with him in a car when they came out, was a postmaster. And they lived in a garage in Santa Fe, somebody's house, because housing was so bad. So we were very lucky to get a house in Marin City.
So, but most of Marin City was built in about 3 months in order to house the workers.
Yes.
For the
there's
Liberty
still muddy
and
roads and all that stuff. Yes.
So there were some houses there as well.
Yes.
And you were in one of them.
Yes. That's where I spent my high school days. Except that as a senior, I think, we moved to Sausalito. My dad and mother both sang in the choir there and back in Charles City. My mother was quite a good singer. So they ran into somebody who had a house, and we rented it.
In Sausalito?
Yeah.
From
and
renting in, did you rent in Marin City or buy?
Oh, you can't buy in Marin City then. It was all rental.
So you then moved to, where in Sausalito were you living then?
On Johnson Street.
Oh, yes.
Just up from the fire station. station, as a matter of fact. In fact, the fire horn scared the heck out of us every afternoon because it was aimed right at our yard.
So can you back up just a bit here?
Yeah.
You're how old now when you're taking the ferry across into Marin County?
13.
So what were your impressions at that time when you're looking around and all that
water?
Well,
first of all, we had gone through kind of another stormy thing on the Altamont Pass.
Mm-hmm.
Because it was also storming, and we got to Marin County. It was gorgeous, but it was not anything like we expected. Our vision of California was Southern California,
mm-hmm.
and this is quite different, as you realize. And so, but it was such a relief to be here. And at first, it was difficult because everything was rationed. Or you had to stand in line to get meat before rationing went into effect. So the whole family would go and stand to get a pound of hamburger,
mm-hmm.
you know, and things like that. I discovered that I was dressed like an Iowa farm boy going to mass. And I didn't fit in at all with the clothes I had.
What are the clothes that an Iowa farm boy going to mass wears?
Dressy clothes.
So you were more formally attired.
Yeah.
Did you wear a little jacket?
A shirt and a jacket and trousers. But here, everything was either Levi's or cords.
Mm-hmm.
And you couldn't get either. Because they had been, it all was wartime. And so everything was, all the cotton was going into uniforms.
So you were condemned to be a hayseed from Iowa.
Yes, well, it took about 6 months for me to finally get assimilated, I guess you'd call it. And I was called an Okie for the first time. I didn't know what it was.
Uh-huh.
Well, of course, I looked like somebody from...
Because you're very fair. People that are listening to this can't see what I'm looking at, which is... very blue eyes.
Yeah. Little red shot in the side.
Yeah, but obviously you were very fair.
Yes.
And
my background was theoretically French-Canadian and Irish and a little German,
mm-hmm.
and a little bit of English. We had all sorts of stuff going for us.
So
my grandfather was a real mixture. And...
So did you have an Iowan accent? Did you?
Oh, I still do periodically. My wife tells me that all the time. Whenever I get angry or upset, I go right into it. I don't recognize it, of course, because I've been here so long. I feel like I'm in California.
So you're 13 years old and you're looking at a lot of water, though. There's no water really to speak of. Like, no oceans in Iowa.
That was scenic, know. But, of course, we came into San Rafael, and it's kind of funny. The road that these people lived on was Scenic Avenue. So we figured it'd be on the waterfront.
Mm-hmm.
But not in San Rafael. It's around the back. Anyhow, we finally found a place and met up with our family.
So you ended up eventually in Sausalito on Johnson, which is really close to town, which is it's a charming town.
And that was one of the places, the last place that I used to work at a grocery store in Marin City. I worked at a, high school kid. I worked as a clerk in Gruber's department store. And in
where
Marin
is
City.
Gruber's?
Well, it was also Sausalito, but that's where I got my Levi's. I worked for the store, and I could get them under the counter. And then we went, the last store I had was at Perry's, and that's still there.
What is it?
Perry's.
Paradies. Where is
Perry's Market.
Oh, Perry's Market, yes.
And it was while that I was there that I joined the Musicians Union, and I started playing.
Okay, so now how old are you?
16.
So where did you learn how to become a musician? I mean,
I just did it. Graduated at TAM.
Cause you went to TAM High.
That's right, and there was a very wide music program at the time.
And you're
I took dance band. I also took orchestra.
So this is, you're the class of?
46.
So you're the class of 46 at Tam High. I hear a lot about Tam's, the education the classes offered. Many wonderful things. It's almost a trade school. I mean, it really, what
that
was
the Duke. He was the first principal or first superintendent. And that was, he graduated from Cal with honors, but he believed in everybody should have
a vocation.
Vocation. And that's why the school was run the way it was. And that was, he got to the point where he was very dictatorial. And he, well, anyhow, that's another trip.
But you learned to play, and your instrument is?
Double bass, string bass.
String bass.
I finally gave it to my son Paul when I...
That's the standing bass, like the big cello.
Yes,
right. Yes.
And I also, when I, well, before I retired, I was playing electric bass. But
how do you play the string bass in a band? I mean, in the marching band? Did you say you were in the marching?
No, never. I didn't march.
Mm-hmm.
Not until I went to the National Guard. I was in the 49th Infantry Division Guard Band.
Uh-huh.
And I joined that while I was a student at State because I was worried about the Berlin blockade.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if that...
Let's go back, though, before we get to your college, back to high school.
Mm-hmm.
So you're playing your instrument. You've got your bass. That was the one that you liked,
mm-hmm.
the instrument you liked. And now you're apparently have some ability, natural ability?
Yes. I discovered the fact that I really could do it and do it well. And that was a real eye-opener for me because up to that point, I was, my sister's the one who always got the A's.
Mm-hmm.
I got the B's.
Mm-hmm.
And that's oversimplification, of course. But the point is that I was used to not being...
Number one.
Yes. And so that I suddenly was number one.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that kind of grabs you after a while.
That what?
Yeah, it grabs me after
a while. It grabbed you, yeah,
right.
I'm sure.
Yeah. At that time, all the good bass players and experienced bass players were in the Army. So people needed a bass. And
hands up for Mr. Green.
In fact, I did very well. I played every probably summer resort in California. And, the year I started teaching, I made more money playing than I did teaching.
So we'll get to that because I know there's quite an interesting story about you as a musician and a teacher. Let's go to your college. So you went to San Francisco State?
Yes.
Okay.
And that was a surprise because I didn't think I could afford it. Back in the Middle West,
mm-hmm.
state colleges were expensive.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, they weren't in Charles City, so I just figured, well, I'm not going to college. My counselor said, why aren't you going to college? And I said, I can't afford it. She said, yes, you can. Those were the days when Earl Brown had managed to get tuition down to $10.50 a semester.
What? Oh my gosh.
Well, it worked then.
Oh.
And I did it. And State was probably the best state college applied music program in the state. And in fact, it really was very good because all the little teachers were in the symphony. You know, the people who did the master classes, like my teacher played in the symphony.
The San Francisco Symphony.
Yeah, right. And I took trombone lessons from Orlando Giosi, who was also in the symphony, his first trombone. And I took my bassoon instruction from a guy who played in the symphony. And, I can't remember now all of them, but they were there and really created a tone. And of course, the other thing was different. My first year at State was the year that GIs came back home to school.
Mm-hmm.
And so here I am, I just graduated from high school. I did pretty well, and of course I did play piano at the time, a little bit. And I was dumped into this sea of people who had all spent their life for the last 5 years professionally playing. It was a real push to survive. And it was good for me because I realized I could and I did and all that. But, you know, it was like Dave McElhattan was next door in the radio department at State. And did you know Dave?
No.
Of him? He had a program for years on KNBR, I think it was. Anyhow, I played with some really fine people.
So you were sort of forced into excellence.
Yes. That's a very good way of putting it. And I had no choice in order to survive. And, of course, I did want to survive. And so I graduated, and that was 1950. And then I got my first teaching job up in Corning.
Corning.
Yeah. And I was there 1 year.
By Chico.
Yes. Yeah. It's up on, it used to be 99 North. But now there's a freeway, of course, 5, I think it is. And I used to come home on weekends, about every other weekend, to do my laundry and all those domestic things. But it's about a 300-mile trip.
Yes.
It's a good ride. But I did it. What? Funny thing, while I was up there, another friend, a co-student from State, Dick Vartanian was his name.
Dick what?
Vartanian.
Vartanian.
Yeah. And he ended up teaching in Arbuckle.
In where?
Arbuckle.
Arbuckle. Where's that?
It's right near the 4099... Yeah, up, it's in that area.
Uh-huh.
It's a sheep town.
Mm-hmm.
And this guy is a very sophisticated guy. He played piano. Well, we ended up having a New Year's Eve gig in Arbuckle in a bar. And it's one of the funniest experiences I've ever had because everybody in the bar was wearing Levi's boots and hats, you know, Western hats.
These are ranch cowboy types.
Yes, yes, and here we were in our tuxedos. It was a funny night, anyhow. But where did I go? Let's do that. And then that was the April of that year. I was down talking to Van Dyke, who was then superintendent, and who had been my principal at TAM. And knew me, so I went in and I said, you know, someday I'd like to come back and teach here. And he says, well, it's funny you should mention that because we're going to have an opening at TAM because we're going to divide the schools. That was when Drake left TAM.
Mm-hmm.
And in those days, he decided. There was no committee. And he hired me. Ah, not right then, a little later. And I kept saying to myself, you know, if I had to go before a committee, I don't think they would ever hire me.
Connections.
Yes. Well, you know, if it works, it works. And that was the year my dad died, and so I had a real good reason for coming home. And I was there for, I taught school for about 6 to 8 months. And then they drafted me, and I got taken to Korea, and I was over there for 21 months. You'll laugh when I tell you this. I was with a field artillery battalion, and I can now conduct the 1812 Overture with great enthusiasm. I was with 155 Howitzers.
You were what?
155 Howitzers. And they're the one with shells like this, big, picking off a lot. Anyhow, I survived that. And
Were you in combat?
I was in what's called a two-point zone, which was, I was in, I guess, within 12 miles of the main line of resistance.
Enough for you to hear but not smell.
And I did actually have a round in my battery where I was, which reminded me that this was really a war.
And you are how old now?
23.
Okay.
Yeah.
So 21 months.
Yes. In fact, I was really nervous because I got tired of being a flunky, and I ended up being a battery clerk because I knew how to type.
Battery cork?
Clerk.
Clerk. Oh, a battery clerk.
I should explain that I have trouble with diction because I had a cancer operation,
mm-hmm.
which affected my articulation.
But also, these words are I'm not familiar with.
So, oh, okay.
So it's very helpful. I figure if I'm not familiar with them, somebody else may
yeah,
not be as well.
Be, yeah.
So you were a battery clerk.
Yes.
Uh-huh.
And I did that for about 6 months, and then I was able to come home. I was nervous because I was due to leave at the time of the armistice.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought I could get sniggered into going in to do typing for this guy. But fortunately, that didn't happen. And,
you came home relieved.
Yeah, yeah I missed, I was supposed to have been a best man at a dear friend's wedding. And I missed it by 2 weeks. So I couldn't do that. But anyhow, that's one of those funny things that happened.
But you came home in one piece.
Yeah. A little. Afterwards, I occasionally would feel guilty because you hear about all these terrible things. That's why I'm a sucker for all veterans groups.
Mm-hmm.
I always, even if I know they don't do as well as they should, I still donate to them.
Mm-hmm.
But I guess we should put that on the tape.
Well, we can remove it if you want.
That's all right.
Yeah. I mean, this is the reality that you experienced, and
yeah,
I think you
yeah.
aren't the only one.
Oh, I'm sure.
And,
yeah.
So.
But anyhow, then I went back to TAM.
As a teacher.
Yes. Because I was taken away while I was employed, therefore my job was guaranteed.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, it was tough for a while because my head wasn't quite there yet,
mm-hmm.
but and of course the schools had just divided, so that bands, when they divide, don't always divide equally,
mm-hmm.
and that's what kind of happened. But you know, we've persevered.
Yeah, there's always that adjustment coming back from such
yeah.
a different place. We're going to ignore this. It took a while, and then you...
Yeah, and it began to grow, and then after a few years, I had a really good band, and one of the problems we had then was that the feeder program, that's a term that music teachers use, the feeder program in Mill Valley and Sausalito was very poor, almost non-existent.
What does that mean, to have the feeder program? Do you go looking for particular students?
No, they have a teacher down
mm-hmm.
there who has put people together
mm-hmm.
so the kids don't have to start at the high school.
Oh, I see.
And I was stuck. I had no real, there'd be 5 or 6 kids, but you can't put a band together with
hard. These are kids that had already begun
yeah,
their musical
right.
training.
So I had to begin my own players.
Ah,
and
right from the
high school.
ABCs.
And we taught a beginning instrument class almost all the time I was there.
Mm-hmm.
It's only the last, since Joe Angiulo came to Mill Valley that there have been people regularly and of good quality. That sounds terrible. But you know what I'm trying to
yes.
say. They were mature enough that they could grow from where
mm-hmm.
to the next level.
So they had the foundation
yes.
so that they were good and stable, when it came time for more intensive training, they could flourish from that
point.
Yes,
I've often said that the reason I was able to take my orchestra to Vienna was because of Joe. He had done such a good job of preparing the kids before I got them.
And so this was that he prepared them prior to entering Tam High, or
yes.
Once saved, yes.
Yeah.
And so that would have been in all the middle schools.
Yes.
Okay.
And
he had funding to do so.
Pardon me?
He had the funding to do so.
Yes. Well, that Mill Valley, what is it called? The fundraising thing they do is wonderful.
Kiddo?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
That's a wonderful thing. Anyhow, I'll have a little water.
Yes, please.
Now then, where are we going?
We're talking about the good bands. As you now have got your footing, you've come back from your military experience, you've adjusted to civilian life again, you've got your head back in the game, you've got the support of the school feeder program, and now you're starting to get some students and you've got something to work with.
Well, I didn't mention that before that I was teaching choir. And the reason I was teaching choir is because Mabel Pittenger was still doing orchestra. And she was my high school orchestra teacher also.
Mabel, what's her
Pittenger.
Name? Pittenger. Pittenger, Mabel,
yeah,
Pittenger.
P-I-T-T-E-N-G-E-R, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And a nice lady, very sweet, played viola in the Marin Symphony. By the way, I played in the Marin Symphony during this time. For about 10 years, actually. This is beginning to sound very fragmented. But anyhow, I had great success with my choir. And I never liked madrigals.
Mm-hmm.
So I always felt a little defensive. So I always went for the big chorus thing. And I had a chorus of around 60. And we did the Symphony of Psalms by Stravinsky.
Mm-hmm.
All right. We did a couple movements of the Sacred Service by Bloch.
Mm-hmm.
And his granddaughter sang the soprano solo.
Whoa.
You know, they lived in Mill Valley briefly.
Bach's granddaughter?
Bloch.
Bloch.
B-L.
Bloch.
Bloch.
His granddaughter.
Very
lived
famous
in
composer.
Mm-hmm.
Was in charge of the conservatory for a while. And his daughter were the Dimitrovs.
Mm-hmm. Oh, right. Okay.
Okay.
Gotcha.
And this was the Dimitrov, Sita
yes,
Dimitrov.
Yes, the framing,
okay.
Yes.
Uh-huh. All right. And that is a chance for a little side trip because that was so much like Mill Valley people. They were so often professionals, college people with families, amazing entrepreneurs. Nothing like we have now. But they were low-key, they loved their kids, and they wanted everything for them. And that's why it was so easy to do things, because they had private lessons and, you know, all that stuff. And they'd figure out how to figure music in their program, even though they were going to Yale or Harvard.
Uh-huh.
And that's really an accomplishment.
They wanted to culture.
Yeah,
children,
yeah.
Culturize
and that's one of the reasons I was successful. I had nothing but great kids.
And parents supporting you.
Parents to
you.
Support them. And I didn't realize that until it began to change.
Mm-hmm.
And fortunately, by that time, I was ready to leave. But
so now we're looking, you came back from the Korean War around 1950, right? Did you say?
No, 53.
And now you've got your footing. So now so where are we when you're doing your choir, when you're doing your classes, when things are coming together? Are we in the late 50s here or into the 60s?
Late 50s.
Okay.
And in early 60s.
So things are also going on in San Francisco. You've got the beat thing starting up in the 50s, or some progressive thinking?
We had some problems with drugs. Not heavy drugs, but, you know, a lot of pot and stuff like that. And I had kids who were kind of on the fringe who got involved with the Sausalito scene.
The Beatniks and
Sesame. Yeah, well, yes, and that was interesting, but it never got too heavy. It was later that things got out of hand, and my kids were at TAM at the time, unfortunately. But they got over it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the day that Janis Joplin died was probably the day that the good students realized this was not the way to go.
Yeah, so much drugs. And now we're talking into the late 60s.
Mm-hmm.
And you've got, by now, you've got some pretty dedicated students who are very much interested. In fact, in my other interview with Rob Moitoza and Bill Champlin, they're now describing to me, they've described in their interviews, the profound influence that mm-hmm. you had on them. As
I hope so. You know, you never really know. And of course, as my wife will tell you, I always make speeches. So sometimes it sounds like I'm making a speech, but sometimes it really works. Mm-hmm. And then the other thing that I've discovered is that, well, I had one kid. I never, he was a drummer. I had a drum class, and he was in the drum class. And I always insisted the drummers learn how to finger notes on the piano.
Mm-hmm.
And he came to me about 5-10 years after he graduated. You know, Mr. Greenwood, I have loved piano. I've taken piano lessons, blah, 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 blah. And I'm saying, you know, I didn't do anything, really. I just...
You fanned the
followed
flame.
Followed through, yeah. And anyhow...
So did you have any of your own bands? You're a teacher, you're in choir. Did you have your own band?
Yeah, when I was in college. I had kind of made a deal with MCA is not a name you probably understand. Music Corporation of America was the title, and it was a booking agency. And they did all the bands across country. Of course, that disappeared. But that was later, and I was sort of the Bay Area's college band. I did things at Cal and the Catholic schools and the San Francisco area. And they had other people to do the Bay Area, you know, like East Bay and farther around.
What kind of music were you playing?
Dance music.
Dance music. What's your favorite song of those?
It Had to Be You.
It Had to Be You.
That's our favorite song, too.
That's your wife's and you, that's your favorite song?
Yeah.
Speaking of your wife, you must have
oh, funny tale.
Somewhere along
yes.
the way.
Before I was drafted, Evelyn was teaching first grade or second grade in Fairfax, and she had a gal who taught kindergarten with her called B.J. Lavaroni, and she's still living, not for long, though, I'm afraid. And I had in my band, I had hired Chuck Lavaroni. Do you know Charles Lavaroni? The name?
I don't think so.
Okay, no. He's an entrepreneur, among other things, and he ended up being principals of schools and districts and whatever. Anyhow, he played Barry Sax with my band, and they were married, and they said, you know, I think Bob would do very nicely with Evelyn.
They could make beautiful music together? Did he say that?
No. No, Evelyn wasn't really a musician at the time. And so we got together on a blind date, and 2 weeks later we were engaged.
Wow. Wow, that's kind of romantic.
And we've been married 63 years.
Wow. Congratulations.
Mm-hmm. No, we were both ready and you know, and we quit. So my feeling is don't fuss around. Do it. But I had to go to Korea first.
So you had your own band, now you've got a wife, or a promise of a wife,
yeah.
And then you come back, and now we just had to kind of catch up a little there. And now we're back at Tam High, and now we're in the 60s.
Yes, and I was working with other people then.
You were working
yeah,
still as a musician.
Yes. I ended up really working with Walt Tolleson. I don't think you'd know that name now. He's dead. Everybody's dead. But Walter was sort of a... Do you know the Lester Landon?
The what?
Lester Landon.
Lester Landon?
Landon.
Lester Land?
No. Lester Landon is famous back east as being the guy who has bands out.
Oh.
On weekends.
Oh, Lester Landon, no.
Well, he did the same kind of thing here.
Uh-huh.
And usually I worked with Walt, and we played up and down the peninsula and wherever. And
so would you show up in your tux and play professionally all
over? Oh, yeah.
And they would just bring different musicians together to play, and you were just...
Well, it was pretty much the same group every time.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I worked one job. I didn't know what I was getting into. And I was told where to show up in Oakland. And I was the only non-Spanish-speaking person in the room.
And how about the musicians?
They were all Spaniards. And there was somebody, you know, he'd go, and that was enough.
His hands.
And I'd start playing, and I'd get in the right key, and I'd be all right. So it was fun. 3 hours of.
But now, from what I understand, you played with your students as well. You did gigs with Bill, he said, Bill Champlin. And he, for those that are listening to this, and
not gigs. No.
Not gigs? He,
no.
You did.
I never really played his style.
No, but or you played together as Rob Moitoza? Was it you and Rob
yeah,
Moitoza?
Yeah, yeah. Well, Moitoza played stand-up bass as well as electric.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where I worked with him. No, Bill was in band and he was in choir
mm-hmm.
with me. And it was when we were doing Paint Your Wagon, I discovered Jane Marsh. I don't know if you know Jane. She's an opera singer and was the first vocal gold medal winner in Moscow. You didn't know about that. Well, she's left the area because her dad and her mother are both gone, and so she decided she'd move to New York, which is where she worked, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But, no, I've had a couple of opera singers.
Mm-hmm.
And I have 3 kids still in the symphony.
Mm-hmm. Really? So you tell the names of your children are?
Oh, Chandler is a bass player, and both Smileys were with me all 4 years.
Mm-hmm.
And who else? Somebody else I can't think of.
Mm-hmm.
At this point.
That's okay. You'll yeah. think of it later.
And, no, I've had, in fact, Bill's sister, Sally, had a gorgeous voice. I'd hoped she'd study opera. We did the Medium by Menotti.
Mm-hmm. How does that go?
It's an opera.
Yeah, do you, any tune at all you can tell?
No, it's not that kind of opera.
No, you can't do that. Huh?
Well, there are some, but my singing voice is not there anymore. But she was excellent as Baba,
mm-hmm.
the witch, and we toured with that over the East Bay, and I wanted her to study real voice, but she wanted to be another hot mama.
She a rock and roller?
No, she never was rock and roll.
What is a hot mama?
A real growly kind of singing voice.
Oh.
You know, what's her name? The last of the hot mamas. Well, you wouldn't know her anyhow. It's for your time. One of the things that I find very frustrating, I'll share this little detail with you. I decided it was time for me to retire. One day I was talking to a kid in the band, and I said, you know, you play trombone like Casper Milk Toast. And the kid had that waxed over look on his face like he didn't know who in the hell I was talking about. And I thought, oh, that's funny, you know, this is Casper Milk Toast was a very good comic strip in my day.
Mm-hmm.
And so then I was telling faculty members about it. And they had that glazed over look. And I said, okay, it's time to leave. You don't even know things that they are associated with, you know. And
but this is why we do oral interviews. This information should be preserved.
Yeah.
And the names that you say live on in the telling of their your experiences. Yeah. So this is important.
Well, you know, I grew up with a whole set of like Maggie and Jigs and I can't even think of them. Dick Tracy.
Uh-huh.
You know, all those crazy cartoon characters. And now, of course, if they haven't been picked up as a TV program, they've gone. And that's pretty close to where I am.
Well, tell me something. I know you've got to go to a meeting, so let me just check. We've got, you wanted to finish this around 2:30, did you say?
Yeah.
Okay, so we've got 10 more minutes, and then we'll continue this interview a little later if we don't finish it. As a musician and somebody who's teaching music, and suddenly you're in the Bay Area where there's a sudden surge of rock and roll, and you are of another era, how was it for you? You could say you grew up with dance music, you're playing dance music, and all of a sudden there's this rock and roll, and your own students are playing rock and roll now.
Well, I always kidded Bill, as a matter of fact. I said, Bill, for God's sake, when you sing something, make sure you understand the words. Don't mutter them. And he always did. He remembered that when he worked with Chicago.
And so for those who are listening who may not know, Bill Champlin had his own band here.
Sons of Champlin.
Yes.
And in fact, he was part of the original group was called The Opposite Six. And most of those guys have since moved on, but the Sun still exists periodically.
And then he went for a while on to play with Chicago.
Oh, yeah. He was there for 24 years.
Yes, for a very popular
organ. And he sang a lot for him.
Yes. So these are your students have now gone on for, many of them have gone on to careers of their own. And you, in his interview, he says you're with him through all of his career and all the things that you told him and taught him.
I was a father figure for him also, and that helped. But it was shortly after Chicago that I lost my touch with music. Up until that point, I was able to handle it. But then when you got the Oh My Baby stuff and almost obscene lyrics, that's not entertainment. So I blanked out. I did like the Beatles.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, Lennon, I think, is one of the great poets of our time. But and there are other people that are sort of isolated.
Like who? Who would?
Well, I'm saying like right now, Mr. Bublé.
Mm-hmm.
Is wonderful, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Young enough that he's going to be around for a while. I'm still an ardent admirer what's his name? This is one of
them. It'll come.
Yeah. You know, this guy who's my age who's still singing great songs and he sounds.
Oh, Tony Bennett?
Yes.
Oh, yes.
I was trying to think of Benedetti.
No, Tony Bennett.
Oh, that's his name, Benedetti.
Yes. Benedetti, but isn't he a beautiful singer?
And, he's just unbelievable.
Yes.
And there are a couple of the young ladies, even though they wear funny clothes and do funny things with makeup, it's more showbiz, really, than music, which turns me off. But they also sing well.
You mean Lady Gaga?
Like that. Mm-hmm. She's one of them. When she takes her tin bra off and, you know, all those funny things.
She takes her tin bra off.
Yes. Well, you know that thing that sticks way
out.
There's
Madonna, too.
Yeah. That, you don't need that. In fact, that was one of the reasons I was glad I was getting out of the professional business, was that we had begun playing with funny hats and costumes.
Oh, you had to start changing your...
I was still working. Uh-huh. Yeah. And Walter would show up with all these funny hats. I hated hats. Still do. And, you know, it's one of those things where it was showbiz. And I didn't take the music as being showbiz.
What did you take the music as being?
Music.
And what is music to you?
The unspoken connection with everything. You know, you can't really put words unless you have a song, and that's different. But then the combination of the sound plus the words make it more meaningful. But I love opera. We go, in fact, tomorrow we're going to, or Friday, Saturday, we're going to see one of the grand things of Puccini's, which is Turandot. And I love that thing. Mason Dharma, you know what I'm talking about. Mm-hmm. And we actually saw the great one do that once. Mm-hmm. But
when you think about yourself as a musician, you know, can you imagine a life without music?
No. I have reached the point where I'm not really a musician anymore. I don't produce, but I certainly listen. And I'm so grateful that my hearing is good enough that I can hear anybody perform. I have better music hearing than I have speech hearing. And I have to do a little wet down.
So you think when a person's a musician, even though they don't play music necessarily anymore, do you think the musician's soul is always alive?
Mm-hmm. Yes. I shouldn't nod my head because it doesn't record. I think so. And I think sometimes that's an acquired thing, but sometimes it's in you.
And for you?
Yeah.
Was it acquired or was it in you?
It was in me.
Always?
Always. I started violin in the fifth grade. Well, my hands were just too big. But
well, you know, I have to say, the people that are listening to this aren't going to be able to see, but you have very long fingers, beautiful hands.
Well, and that's why the bass worked out so well. I went from violin to the string bass.
I'm going to have to take a picture of you and these hands, I have to say.
Oh.
They are amazing. Quite elegant.
And then I started playing keyboard. And my lessons cost 25 cents. Those were Depression days.
Yes.
And the lady I studied with was the wife of the town band director. Charles said, yeah, you know.
So you mentioned that things have changed around here, and in living in the area, you've lived here for all these years.
It's been probably about six changes. My own reaction was the group that was here when I first came here were predominantly natives, mm-hmm. with a bunch of Okies like me. Mm-hmm. That changed to economically secure people who were in trades and with their children. Again, they're very, you know, encouraging. And then we got into the period of what I call professional people. I've mentioned those where I was teaching then. And we had lots of married professors here with a couple of kids, and they wanted to grow up someplace besides Berkeley, and certainly not San Francisco. But then we got into the first run-of-the-mill post-druggy people, and they seemed to be different in their interests. They started the me culture. And that's when you wouldn't dare drive in Mill Valley because people, you know, that's polite drivers disappeared about that time. And then we got into the period of techies, early techies, not late, not now. And then finally we got into this group of people from New York who escaped New York City, and they wanted another job or another something, so they came out here, and so they settled here in Mill Valley. Well, that's where it is kind of now. And as I say, you just don't want to crosswalk or do anything strange, because there'll be a 45-year-old female, and females are most in a hurry to get where they're going fast, because they've got other things they've got to do. And that's Mill Valley. And my wife tells me this too, it's not just me. You know, people come zooming by you and you say, oh, and you look for a man or a kid, it's 45-year-old, a mother with a kid in the back seat. Yeah, it's very different.
And let's go back to the 60s, when you've got the rock and roll scene going along, and you've got your students. Did the students themselves change in their interest in music with you?
Well, I don't think so. Kids are kids. Mm-hmm. And they don't always agree with their parents, mm-hmm. as you well probably found out. And so they do their own thing. And if they've got a director who seems to know what he's doing, I hope I did, they'll follow.
So I know we need to wind up here, but I do have a couple of questions for you.
Okay, I'll try to be brief.
Okay, so what does it feel like to know that you've been an influence to someone who's gone on to study music, to make music, to have a career in music, that you've been in some form important in the formation?
Well, it sounds phony, but it's very humbling. You know, I grew up in a little town, and I was a hick and didn't do anything, and all of a sudden, you know, and so it's very humbling. And thank you, I enjoy every bit of it. Mm-hmm. And every now and then there are things happening to me that bring it back, you know, and that's great.
For those that are listening and may not have attended, when Bill Champlin came and spoke at the First Wednesday speaker series, you know, he insisted that there'd be a
seat. Oh, he told me I had to be there.
You had to be front row center next to him.
Yes, no.
As well as many of your other students showing up.
Yeah, well, it's hard to tell. You know, my wife was a superb elementary teacher, mm-hmm. but most second graders don't come back and tell her that. It's just something you know. But I have the advantage of some of these kids do come back and, you know, thank me.
Now, I've asked you a lot of questions today. What haven't I asked you that you wish maybe I had? Is there anything that we've missed here in this interview?
Right offhand, I don't know. I've been rambling on.
No.
And,
something important about your experience here. Anything at all about your experience in this community, in this area?
Well, I did enjoy playing with the Marine Symphony. Mm-hmm. Chalgo was the conductor, and I think I was there. They rehearsed in my room at TAM, which mm-hmm. is one of the reasons I was there. I suspect that's why he always let me get by with murder. But because Chicago was a fine conductor. And the symphony did interesting things, and so that was nice. You know, I don't know if I mentioned the fact that while I was working up the what is now Sarah's Sahara state line, one summer was Lena Horne was there.
Oh, my.
I worked for her. And so was the dancing guy. What's his name from?
Fred Astaire?
No. He's still alive, incidentally, which is a thrill.
Was it what kind of dancing?
Oh, you know, song and dance kind of thing. He was in Mary Poppins.
Oh, Dick Van Dyke. Awesome.
Yeah, he was there one time.
Oh, gosh. He's still dancing. I just saw him on a show.
Not much.
Yeah, but he's still trying.
Well, you know, he used to do the pratfall.
Yes.
And obviously killed himself. But,
great entertainer.
No. Yeah. No, and he's a nice guy. Really is. He deserves to live.
Uh-huh.
And so I was so impressed. Lena Horne was such a wonderful woman. You know, she broke the color line at Lake Tahoe.
Yes, right.
And,
what a singer.
Yeah.
So you got to play with some greats.
I've had lots of wonderful opportunities. And this is going to sound terrible, thanks to the Japanese.
Because they brought...
They bombed Pearl Harbor.
The unexpected consequences.
Yes.
If it hadn't been for that...
I would never have met my wife.
Would not have been living in the Bay Area.
It's just amazing. And I say it very quietly because it sounds terrible. But it's true. And so...
Life can flourish even in adversity.
Yes. As the old British comic film used to say, carry on, nurse. I don't know, did you ever see those? There were a whole series of them.
No.
Medical
comedies. That was the segue always.
That's the title.
Carry on, nurse.
Carry on, nurse. Yeah. And that's what you do, you know. Listen, we're going to have to stop.
Okay, well, I just want to say thank you so much for this wonderful interview, Mr. Greenwood. It's a real pleasure to meet you and to talk with you, and thanks for sharing your story.
Well, I'm more than delighted.
Thanks for all the years of beautiful music.
Well, thank you. You didn't ever hear any of it.
Well, I hear what the second generation from, because I grew up listening to the bands that
you... Well, you know, I didn't give a chance to show you my rose gallery.
Okay, so let's turn this off now and I'll take some photos, okay?
Yeah.
All right. Okay, we're going to sign off now.